When preparing this week, it occurred to me something that I hadn't thought about fully before, in that any preacher worth listening to will never be worthy of the message that they're preaching. And I felt that very strongly this week. We have such a small view of grace, and it comes from the fact that we don't understand how lost and broken and desperate and wicked we are, and we don't understand how totally forgiven and accepted and loved and wanted we are. We live as though that unfortunate version of the story is the real one. And I'm hoping sometime in the next few minutes to help us get a big grasp of just how awful and unlovable we really are, how desperately we need God's mercy, and how totally loved, wanted, accepted, and lavish with all sorts of blessings we are. Because that's what the story is all about. So hopefully as a relief, let's have a look at the real version, because I prefer this one. Jesus continued, "There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, 'Father, give me my share of the estate.' So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole land, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, 'How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him and kissed him. The son said to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.' But the father said to his servants, 'Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.' So they began to celebrate. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing. So he called one of his servants and asked him, 'What was going on?' 'Your brother has come,' he replied, 'and your father has killed the fatted calf because he had him back safe and sound.' The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him, but he answered his father, 'Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him.' 'My son,' the father said, 'you are always with me, and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found.'" It's always very hard to preach on familiar passages, and I think this is a great example of one where we know the story really well and it's lost its impact, or we've never quite grasped just how dramatic and astounding this story is. So it breaks down into two very simple parts. We start off with the son's rejection of the father and the father's complete non-rejection of the son. And in that, we see a picture of all humanity and a picture of God's grace. And as I said, we underestimate human lostness and we underestimate the totality of God's salvation. And by these two heresies, we end up with a really, really small view of grace. I think if we see grace, God's grace as it really is, it will be nothing short of life-changing. A couple of words on cultural context. The original hearers of Jesus' story would have been entirely shocked and appalled in a way that doesn't necessarily translate into English too well, and certainly for those of us who've heard this story too many times, we miss. The pigs bit is fairly obvious, but Jesus is being deliberately provocative. Not only is he caring for the pigs, the archetypal unclean animal, but he wants to even eat what the pigs are eating, but he can't even manage that. Jesus is painting a picture of complete depravity, that's what he's trying to say. And the son could not be in a worse place, having squandered everything. The Jewish hearers of Jesus' story could not imagine anything worse than being sent to 10 pigs. And he's so low, he can't even eat what the pigs are eating. But that's not the most shocking part of the story. The most shocking part of the story is when the son comes home, the version that Mike so brilliantly read for us is not a patch on what the original readers would have been expecting. If Jesus had paused at that moment and you took a survey, the response of the father would have been wrathful, I think, at the very least. The highest sin in the Jewish way of thinking is patricide, to kill one's father. The disrespect for one's father is essentially unforgivable to the Jewish mindset. And that's what the son has done, in effect. Obviously, the story doesn't involve actually killing him, but Jesus made it clear that wishing someone dead, hating someone that much, is the same sin of the heart. And the son says, "Father, give me my half of my inheritance." Literally, "Dad, I wish you were dead. All that you have that's yours and that might be mine in future, I just want it now. I wish you were dead." And of course, Jesus is not just speaking about a father-son relationship, but he's talking about all of us. What I like to call functional atheism. Unfortunately, I don't meet very many well-thought-out philosophical atheists, because they're quite fun, and they always have interesting conversations. The problem is that in a nation of can't-be-bothered agnosticism, we're all functional atheists. We're not really sure whether God's there or not, but we live as though he's not. We live as though God doesn't matter. Even if he exists, well, he can't be that important. And I suspect that all of us, if we're honest, know that we live quite a lot of our lives like that. We claim to worship and follow God, but we live our lives as though he's not there. This is at the true heart of all sin and all evil, is displacing God from his right place. First commandment, love the Lord your God with your heart, mind, soul, and strength. We de-God God. We take him away from his rightful place at the center of the universe. Which, if you think about it, is the most ridiculous thing to do. God made the universe. It all belongs to him. Apparently I have some talents, but I haven't made a universe recently. Mostly because I don't have any spare time, but anyway. This is Don Carson reflecting on Genesis 3. I think we can get bogged down in Genesis 3, and it's very uncomfortable in our culture because it's the story that's mostly laughed at and cartoonish. And I don't really care about which bits are literal and which bits are symbolic. The theology of it is really important because it's at the center of understanding what the Bible message is all about. Because if you don't understand the problem, the solution that Jesus presents by dying on a cross will never make any sense. It will be just profoundly ridiculous. In the beginning, there is God, and the creatures that are made in his image wake up in the morning and they think of him. They orientate themselves to him. They love him with heart and mind and strength. They are rightly related to each other precisely because they are rightly related to him. And so they live and move and they speak and think in a self-conscious dependence on him. And now you see, by the origin of sin in the world, each now thinks that he or she is God, the center of the universe. Not ontologically, of course, but functionally. That's the way it works. Now, if this God exists, if he, she, or it exists, this God jolly well better serve me because I'm the center of the universe. And if this God does not serve me, then frankly, I will find other gods, thank you. Which is the beginning of idolatry. It's also the beginning of fences and the beginning of jealousy and the beginning of violence and the beginning of hate and the beginning of rape and the beginning of greed. All because I say, I will be God. Deification may not be something we self-consciously hunger for, as if we self-consciously say, I want, ontologically speaking, to be God. Nevertheless, even the briefest reflection shows how we want to rule, how we want to be in control, how we want to be the center of attention. We want others to serve us. How quickly we lose our cool when we are dismissed or marginalized or put to the side. What is this but the residual passion to be God? In our culture, it is profoundly unpopular and unacceptable to talk about the lostness, the brokenness of humanity, which I think is strikingly ironic when you look at the world. Famously, in the early part of the 20th century, the editor of the Times asked several prominent writers to answer the question, what is wrong with the world? And G.K. Chesterton replied, dear sir, in answer to your question, what is wrong with the world? I am. I'd be very surprised if any of you have heard of Thomas Rosenthal. He is one of the justices at the International Criminal Court. And before that, he was a human rights lawyer in the States. And before that, he was a Holocaust survivor. And his autobiography is called A Lucky Child, because somehow he survived the death camps. And I heard him interviewed on the radio a few years ago when his book came out. And he made the most startling statement that has disturbed me ever since. Is that when he looked at the Holocaust, the wickedness of the leaders is obvious, but the vast, vast majority of the atrocities were committed by very ordinary, nice, normal people in the wrong circumstances. We love to underestimate our capacity for evil. We love to see ourselves as not too bad. I think all of us have to be honest and realize what we're capable of. Without the things that restrain us. We cry out for justice for the things done against us, but we're not quite so interested in justice for the things that we've done. And God's standard is absolute perfection. You may be able to say, I'm not quite as bad as some, but that's still nowhere near God's standard. In our lifetime, the 20th century was the bloodiest ever. Apart from war, the human race managed to kill off 6 million Jews, 1.5 million Gypsies, 1.5 million Armenians, maybe 20 million Ukrainians, probably around 50 million Chinese, a third of the population of Cambodia, 1 million Hutus and Tutsis. That's before you talk about street violence, domestic violence, AIDS. Over 100 million violent casualties in the 20th century, apart from war. And yet we live in a culture that says there is no such thing as evil. Evil is a profound reality, and all of us are contaminated by it. And yes, by the grace of God, we're not as bad as we might be. What theologians like to call common grace, for the record, Paul. God's standard is absolute perfection. You know what? A God whose standard with anything else would not be worth worshipping, would not be worth knowing. All of us have displaced God's rightful place from the centre of the universe. All of us have said, I know better than God. I mean, how ridiculous is that? He made you. He made everything around you. And yet all of us long to rule and overturn his rightful place. That's the profound wickedness of sin. That is the human condition. That's what's wrong with the world. I am. And the Son, realizing how bad things had got, makes the startling decision to head back to his Father and plead for something. Anything, scraps on the table, would be better than where he was. And I don't think there's any doubt that his expectations would be very similar to the version that Mike read for us. But that was better than where he was. Turn with me to Romans 3. Now, we're going to start at Romans 3:21. If you read Romans from the beginning, Romans, of course, is Paul's most theological letter. And the first 2.5 chapters after the introduction, Paul spends a lot of time basically to make the one very simple point. No one is righteous, not even one. And as he says in verse 10, as it is written, no one is righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away and have become worthless. There is no one who does good, not even one. It's very heavy going, the first couple of chapters, and then you get to this blessed relief. A huge sigh of relief when you get to verse 21. But now, apart from the law, the righteousness of God has been made known, to which the law and the prophets testify. This righteousness is given through faith in Jesus Christ to all who believe. There is no difference between Jew and Gentile, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, and all are justified freely by his grace through the redemption that came by Christ. God presented Christ as a sacrifice of atonement through the shedding of his blood to be received by faith. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness because in his forbearance he had left the sins committed beforehand unpunished. He did this to demonstrate his righteousness at the present time so as to be just and the one who justifies those who have faith in Jesus. What Paul is saying is that God can still be a perfect and total judge. He cannot let any of the sins and the evil in the world just go by as if they don't matter. Because that's what we're saying when we're trying to say that we're not all bad. We're trying to say that these things don't matter. And so God finds the solution in the cross, that his love, desperate to win us back, is able to maintain his justice. Now, there's a bit of technical theology in here, which is not just for Paul's benefit. Bear with me. I hope it will be worth it. In verse 25, God presented Christ as sacrifice of atonement. The translation there, it varies a bit between versions. And probably the word that belongs there is propitiation. And I won't ask for show of hands for anyone who knows what propitiation means. It's a pagan concept, and Paul is deliberately appealing to the knowledge of the pagan practices of his original readers. And we're familiar with this, the idea that if you're going to war, you make a sacrifice to the god of war. If you want your crops to grow, you make a sacrifice to the god of the crops. If you want the sun to shine, sacrifice to the god of the sun. And all pagan practices in all cultures have followed this pattern, from the Greek pagans, the Roman pagans, to the Celtic pagans, the sacrifice. And the idea is very simple, is that you want to propitiate the god. You want the god to be favourable to you. And so you offer a sacrifice to induce that favour. It's the act of propitiation. Now, about 70 years ago, this particular concept caused a massive controversy amongst the universities of theological colleges in the UK. There's one man who felt that given that God loved us enough to send his own son, he was already totally propitious. He was already totally favourable towards us. How could he possibly become more favourable? And you see, the man was called Dodd. He was a Welshman, but I won't hold that against him. He was profoundly right and profoundly wrong. Because we have to understand that God sits in righteous judgment over us. We are not deserving of God's favour. And yet, God himself provides the method and the sacrifice to meet that justice. You see, God propitiates himself. This is what's so distinctive about the Christian theology. There is nothing you can do to make God love you more. There's nothing you can do to make God love you less. And in his love, desperately wanting you back, it's God himself who provides the sacrifice. There's nothing you need to do. God's done it all. And that leads us on to this fantastic, awesome image of God. Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. This parable is not against having fun and living a good and happy life. Although that's kind of what the son did, but he did it out of selfishness. There's a feast and a big party when the son comes back, because the father is overjoyed to see his son again. I wonder what our standard image of God is. The bank manager noticing we're overdrawn again. The doddering old man, which is the one that always bemuses me most, because the God who makes the universe is certainly not frail. I think that that's generally how we see God. Maybe the petulant child who's smiting us for us not living up to his arbitrary rules. It's not the God of the Bible. God of the Bible is awesome and scary when he's in righteous judgment. And it's righteous judgment. It is what we deserve. It is not petulance. It's not merely smiting at the things that we like. And you notice if you get rightly related to God, then human beings start being rightly related to each other. This is the kingdom that Jesus is always describing. And so the image of God that Jesus presents us with here is undignified, maybe even ridiculous, certainly extreme. As I said before, the original Jewish readers would have been shocked and appalled by the son's sin against his father, but even more shocked by the father's response. If the father had let him anywhere near the family home, he would have sent the lowest servant to greet him. But no, Jesus describes a father who, whilst he was still a long way off, he saw him and he ran to him and threw his arms around him and kissed him. This is the image of God that Jesus is describing to us. You are unbelievably wanted, unbelievably loved. I think we find ourselves living the unfortunate version that Mike read for us before, feeling vaguely guilty about all the wrong things. God doesn't do tolerance. Doesn't tolerate us. He forgives and restores us completely. You may have noticed Jesus was never remotely easygoing on matters of holiness. In fact, most of the time he tended to make things more difficult. Don't just not commit adultery, but don't fester, let lustful thoughts fester in your mind so you're thinking about another human being in that way. And yet, this is the Father who desperately wants us back. If you have Luke in front of you, you may have noticed that, as the NIV puts it, it's the parable of the lost son rather than the traditional name. And the reason for that is there's these three parables together. The parable of the lost sheep, the parable of the lost coin, and the parable of the lost son. And they all finish with, they all have the same point to them in slightly different ways. In the lost sheep, Jesus says, I tell you in the same way, there'll be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents. Parable of the lost coin, of the woman who lost 10 silver coins, had 10 silver coins and lost one. And then when she finds one, she calls all her friends and neighbours together to celebrate. Rejoice with me, because I found my lost coin. And we hear in this story of the father throwing a massive party for his lost and wayward son. This is the joy of God over you. This is the point of the three stories together. This is the grace of God. It's not that he wants to tolerate you. It's he wants you back. He wants you restored. He wants you blessed. He wants you to be all that you can be, all that you were made to be. I firmly believe in a God of healing in every way. And a God who loves you more than you can possibly imagine. Do you think we can maybe grasp just something of how big grace is? How totally lost and wicked and depraved we really are, or were? How totally saved? How God is so pleased to have you? How richly he wants to bless you? We're going to close with the great Wesleyan hymn, And Can It Be? The words of the first verse show Wesley had great poetry. Died he for me who caused his pain, for me who him to death pursued. I killed Jesus, but he did it willingly for me. And the astounding words repeating what Paul writes in the final verse. Bold I approach the eternal throne and claim the crown that belongs to me because of Jesus. Let's try and get a bigger view of grace.